Welcome to Love Amped, an exploration of healing others through healing ourselves. Check out loveamped.com for additional resources and support.
Love Amped. Hello, friends, and welcome back to Love Amped. I'm your host, Seth Pearson, and this week we are talking with a legend, a healer of communication. I'm not even going to say her name. We're just going to jump into it. All I have to say is, dreams come true, and anything is possible.
She doesn't know where I am right now. She has no clue. I'm like, Aaron, marry you! I was under the desk! Obviously, I was under the desk.
What a shock, what a surprise. I am delighted beyond belief.
So great. How did we do this? How did this come together? No one saw this coming. They didn't know. Woo! That it was possible. Aaron Merrihew is on Love Amped, people. This is what dreams are made of. This is undeniably, we've thought we've reached the pinnacle multiple times, you know, and we have, and we just did it again. Aaron, whoa. Like, was there a point in your life where you had trouble loving yourself?
There still are points all the time, Seth. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's, you know, unfortunately, part of the human condition, but absolutely, there have been many points throughout my life that I've struggled to love myself, and it's an ongoing practice.
Mm. Is that one of the reasons that you got into the work that you got into?
In hindsight, yeah. I don't think I realized that at the time. I think the tricky thing about self-hate or any version of self-hate is that when we are struggling with it, we don't realize that we're in self-hate, you know, like most of us. It just feels true. We're just in a place of suffering that feels true and real. And so I wouldn't say that I necessarily said, I want to love myself more. And that's why I want to, sign up for a communication class or see a therapist or understand my own spiritual practice. Like, I don't know if that's what was driving me, but in hindsight, everything along that journey has been about self-acceptance and self-love.
Mm. And being drowned in that kind of self-hatred, as you would put it, is there a way that you have found to see through the self-hatred now? Or like see that, how are you able to start to recognize, oh, I'm doing this again. Oh, I'm in this again.
Yeah. So many different things come to mind. What immediately jumped to mind when you asked that was this book that I read at the beginning of my sort of my spiritual journey, in 2013 was a big turning point for me. And I left a relationship and a business and a life down in Bolivia. And it was really heartbreaking. And that was kind of this moment when I realized that I wanted to pivot and heal. And this book that showed up in my life at that time is called There Is Nothing Wrong With You by Sherry Huber. I don't know. Have you heard of that book?
I haven't actually.
Okay. It's a good one. It's sort of like a illustrated graphic novel in some ways. And, just does a really great job of starting to put language to the difference between self-hate and self-love. And I think that book is kind of a symbol for me because it's the answer to your question. Like, mm-hmm. Whether it's that book or some other practice, starting to discern between what self-love sounds and feels like on the inside and what self-hate sounds and feels like. Mm-hmm. Not that it's always binary like that, but, you know, getting to know those narratives and feelings and experiences, it's just undeniable the difference between between those energetic states.
Mm-hmm. And what would you, how would you see that within yourself once you started reading that book and you're like, oh, this is kind of what this is? Like,
yeah, I mean, so much of it is just developing self-awareness, which just happens through paying attention to the voice in my head, paying attention to how my body's feeling, how my heart's feeling, and then just starting to track, you know, what is going on inside of me. A big part of the practice, and I think this is kind of the first step in so many different modalities and schools of thought, is just being the observer of oneself. And that's kind of the foundation, I think, of any self-love discovery process. Mm-hmm. Just starting to notice, like, what am I telling myself? How am I feeling? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, developing the capacity to look at that without judging it.
Right. And so when you wouldn't connect to your body, what kind of situations would you get yourself into?
Like when I would try to track what's going on in my body?
And maybe before you would track what was going on in your body.
So you're saying, like, maybe you can ask that another way, like what situations would I find myself in? Or
yeah, or like that time that, like, maybe the moments before you started on that spiritual healing mm-hmm. journey in 2013. What kind of situations did you get yourself into that were really tough?
Yeah. You know, I'm just sort of marveling in this moment at the difference between the external circumstances and the internal conditions and how those things can have a relationship, but so often it doesn't necessarily matter what exactly the stimulus was from outside, if it takes me to a place inside that's painful, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of the circumstances I was in were, you know, being abroad, living away from home, living with my ex-partner and in a bilingual relationship, so speaking a language that wasn't my mother tongue, and doing things that were really outside of my comfort zone. So building a business that was in its first phase, kind of a lot of manual labor. And so there are a lot of situations that just put me out of my comfort zone. And then the challenge of communicating across a language barrier and a culture barrier. My ex was also half Bolivian, half German. And so there were just all kinds of you know, that's the chapter that really stands out to me when we lived in Bolivia and we lived in Germany. Both of those experiences started to really put me in more discomfort than I had known probably in my adult life. And even prior to that, you know, I think there's just been a lot of chapters in my life where I'm curious and I love to adventure and discover, and spent a gap year or took a leave of absence in undergrad and traveled and visited 13 countries in Latin America across 8 months, backpacking alone as a woman at age 19, you know. So mm-hmm. you can imagine there's a lot of sort of unusual circumstances I found myself in. But I think regardless of what the specifics were, I think the common ingredient was shame and reactivity from that shame. And that was the place that I found myself trapped most frequently. And a lot of repressed rage that was held with that shame.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of, what was kind of like your internal dialogue, if you remember, like if you had like some frequent ones that showed up?
Goodness, it's so hard to jump back into that time in my life and try to even remember. I mean, I can say some that continue to be dialogues I work with and that I'm working on loving, you know, still to this day. Probably things like, people don't like me, or I don't belong here, I'm different and that's bad. I'm too much. I'm nobody understands me, and therefore I'm bad. Mm. What else is in the regular?
Yeah, I love this.
Yeah, I mean, those are definitely some common ones. I mean, lately I've been really noticing just this really deep root level, like I'm just bad at my core. I'm just really bad, and kind of the resistance to love that shows up from that root belief. So there are all kinds of narratives that can come from that root, but I would say that's the one that's been working me lately that I think is probably the underpinning of any shame spiral. Yeah.
And when you're having like those shame spirals, maybe with that core one, are you then trying to like find like examples of this is why I'm bad? Like this is why this makes sense? Or,
oh yeah, I don't have to work to find them. My brain does that, you know, on autopilot. It's like, that's just goes with the territory of being in shame, right? Like, I'm not even having to try to think of those examples. They are just like suffocating me, right? So like in that place of deep shame, that's all I can see. That's all I'm present to. I see the world through the lens of my own badness and wrongness. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying me, but you know, any person.
Right. Yeah. And so now you have a little more tools than you used to.
Oh, yeah.
What's one that you used to get out of that?
Say that again.
What's one of the tools that you used to get out of one of those spirals?
To get out of a shame spiral. Yeah. Gosh, this is so alive for me, Seth. I'm loving your questions. And I'm also like, I feel like I'm starting to sweat over here, which is beautiful too. Cause just this past week has been like a major exploration for me around shame and a particular kind of shame hook that I am exploring in myself. So recently, one of my favorite tools is to forgive the shame. It's like a really, sounds like too simple, but it's actually been wonderful medicine for me. And this is something I drew from the work of Gabby Bernstein. I really love her work. And, you know, she has this idea and she draws it from the A Course in Miracles, kind of to trace back that line of work. And it's basically just the idea that anytime we notice that we have detoured out of a loving state, that we forgive ourselves for that misstep. Mm-hmm. We understand that that is not the truth of who we are. We understand that that's not aligned with our higher self. And we forgive ourselves, because one of the places we can really get stuck where the shame just kind of really takes us under is we make ourselves wrong for making ourselves wrong. Like, it's just, we layer on that, you know, that extra layer of shame on whatever challenging or uncomfortable, painful experience we've already fallen into. So that's been my lately, like when I'm really grasping for a tool and I'm really struggling, it's like, can I just forgive myself right now for the feeling I'm having, this shame that I'm experiencing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Amazing. And like, how long does that process take for you? Or like, would you say, like, until you kind of get back to, whoa, okay.
Yeah.
That was another one of those. All right. Like, we cut through it.
Oh, it totally varies. I mean, one of the things I've noticed about doing this work is that it's like the more skills I gain to work with it, the deeper the challenges that arise, because I sort of worked through the more surface layer shame stories, right? So like if I get taken down in a shame spiral, it's going to be deeper and harder to come out of probably than some of the ones that I can just metabolize really quickly. So if we're talking about just sort of a really superficial shame spiral, I can come out in a matter of seconds or minutes. I mean, I can identify the thought, realize it's shame, forgive myself, move toward a more loving thought, you know, like, but when we're talking on this sort of almost like an unconscious level, that can take me days. and I usually need support. So it's depends on the severity of that experience and also, you know, how I'm spending my time and what I'm accountable to during that time. But it often will require me, when it's a really deep shame spiral, it will require support from somebody else to attune with me and almost like show me what it would be like to be loving to me in that place. Sometimes I just get so far from that kind of seed of self-love that I can't even imagine what it would feel like or sound like in that moment.
Wow. And so some of the, what you've been experiencing recently, is it with that core piece? Does it feel connected to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the piece that I'm working with, and I'm hoping that this will resonate with people as well, because I think it is really universal, is when I have a vulnerable need that I haven't even been aware of myself, and then I experience a rejection of that need. And I say I experience it, right? Because sometimes nobody is actually intending to reject me. Most of the time, they're not. But I can interpret something as a rejection of that need, and then suddenly I'm filled with just immense shame and rage. And I can really just go into this separate energy, right? This energy of like, you and I are not the same. You know, we are not together. We're not on the same team. I'm against you. You're against me. And I just protect and defend and can be actually quite cruel to myself and others in that place. And so what I'm working with is taking a step back and doing what's actually just excruciating work, but so worthwhile, of like, okay, Erin, so what was the original need? What was so painful that it got rejected? You know, like, what was that thing you were needing? And a lot of times it's not even like on a verbal level. It's more just like, I can feel that place in myself where the ache is, where that vulnerability is. And this is the hardest piece to work with, is when we aren't aware of even having a need. And I think a lot of times that's the place where we really get taken under by our shame. Like, we didn't even realize that that there was vulnerability in what we were putting out there. And then it's just like a sea anemone that just, you know, shrinks back in. Like, tentacles are just completely taken aback. You know, that's the image I have for that place. And it does take, you know, a lot of gentleness and a lot of care and sometimes support, like I said, to find the root of that reaction and that pain.
Mm-hmm. And so you kind of touched upon the idea that when you're in that state and you kind of get into the realm of like, kind of defensiveness and potentially attack, would you consider that being in kind of a self-sabotaging state?
I would say sometimes, you know, the intention of self-sabotage from the level of belief systems is always self-protection. So I think that really it's important to look at that whenever we talk about self-sabotage, because we can talk about it as if it's like just this sort of like crazy behavior, right? Like, why would I just take myself down? Why would I undermine the things that matter to me, the relationships that matter to me? And we can, in framing it that way, shame ourselves, right? So I would identify it as self-sabotage, absolutely. But I just felt it was important to add that layer of self-sabotage is at its heart misguided self-love. So we got to go back and understand what belief system is triggering this defensiveness to show up, because defensiveness is self-protection. That's perceiving a threat to something I care about or something sacred to me. And so where is that perception happening? Where did it start? When did we first start feeling this way? What was happening? Like, tracing it back and then doing that emotional work to figure out what needs to be clarified, what truth needs to be found, refound. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, that is, I personally, in the realm of self-sabotage, that's like one of the most beautiful ways I've ever heard it put. Like, and because it shows, at least to me, the honesty behind self-sabotage, that it's another layer of at least showing that one is not bad because of it. It's like it's releasing shame even more. It's a reminder that it's not their fault. It's not your own fault. It's not our own faults that self-sabotage happens.
No, it's definitely not. And in fact, I talk a lot with my clients about signs of resilience. Like, a lot of their most toxic patterns are a sign of resilience at the time that they formed. Mm-hmm. You know, so a lot of our patterns are rooted in self-protection, and whatever the conditions were that we grew up in, we developed the greatest sign of resilience we could at that time. And what happens is, just as we evolve and we become adults and we have a lot more choice about the circumstances we're in and the relationships we're in, we have completely different, you know, needs and opportunities. And a lot of those behaviors that were a sign of resilience when we were young are not relevant anymore. And they're actually undermining the core things that matter to us. So, yeah, I think it's so important to look at any of our self-sabotage behaviors and even our self-hate behaviors as an attempt to protect ourselves in some way.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now, it's great because there a lot of people that I know already know about you. Like, the full extent of, like, what you have given to me in my life, and what and like how, you know, how I view you. And now those out there that don't know, Erin Merrihew, incredible nonviolent communication teacher, boundaries teacher, a healer to this world, a power and force of good. And let's just say we finally had our first one-on-one session the other day. And this is my note. This is my physical note that I wrote during that entire time that we talked. She rocked my world. That's all I wrote down there.
Oh my goodness. That's literally what you wrote, Seth?
That's literally what I wrote.
I love that. Oh, you know it's a good session when there's just a one sentence and it's that sentence.
And so on my own journey through self-love and becoming a better communicator, learning about myself and boundaries and my own patterns, the past, all the good stuff that gets blasted open when taking courses like this. What would you say is the briefest overview of nonviolent communication?
Well, I think of nonviolent communication as a set of tools that guides us to get in touch with an open-hearted, compassionate, understanding place in ourselves. And it's a place that we all carry inside of us that gets really distorted through conditioning, painful experiences, systems of power and oppression that are damaging for us, you know. And these tools give us kind of a map to come back to that beautiful innocence in each of us and to see each other more clearly. See each other's hearts more clearly through challenge and through disagreement or pain.
Love that. And when I came to your class for the first time in, I believe it was October of 2018, and it was as I was learning and integrating from a previous relationship, and really like figuring out, hold on, my needs in a relationship matter? What? Are you serious? And like, little did I know that as I was going through your program, that I was starting to get these hints of like, hold up, is that self-love? Am I saying, wait a minute, is that a little nugget of self-love right there? Hold on. And then I would go on Wikipedia and look up Marshall Rosenberg, you know, one of the creators of nonviolent communication, and see the history of how it was implemented. And I saw that in the late 2000s, like early 2010s or whatever, that there then began a realization and like a movement within that like practicing of nonviolent communication, that self-compassion was starting to show up and be like advocated for. And I was like, interesting. Yeah,
it is interesting. I didn't know, like, you know, I feel like there's so much to learn about the history of nonviolent communication. It's such a fascinating subculture, really. And I didn't realize that, although it does make sense, because I think in some ways, you know, the research and the practices that are more mainstream around self-love and self-compassion really have only emerged in the last decade or so, although obviously they've been a vital part of a lot of different spiritual traditions for a long time.
Right, man. And who was the, like, what, was there a person in your life that sent you, like, nonviolent communication your way? Or how did it first pop in?
Yeah, actually a dear friend of mine who had also, she had kind of a similar life path at that time. And so she had also been living abroad and had just moved home in the dead of winter. And we were both kind of seeking, you know, we were seeking healing, self-discovery. We had gone to high school together, and she, a friend of hers, or a mutual friend of ours, I think had invited her, and then she passed it along to me, and it was a free introduction to nonviolent communication. And yeah, it's so sweet to look back at that time, because I think for a lot of us, the moments where our life is going to change forever in just the most miraculous and beautiful way, they seem like just sort of ordinary moments in our life when they're happening. You know, like, I remember going and dropping off my check for the course beforehand and picking up my book from my teacher at that time and having a little chat. And it's like, he would go on to be my mentor, you know, for the next 5 years and become like a dear, dear friend of mine. And this work would become my full-time livelihood. And I had no idea that was going to happen.
That's amazing. That's beautiful. It's funny, I'm just like here, like, parallel experience of just, I mean, I signed up for the class after your free like afternoon kind of session.
Yeah.
And I was like, I mean, this seems right. Like, this seems like the thing to do. I as a lot of things that I sign up for in this realm, I'm like, I don't fully know what I'm gonna get out of this. And then it's just, and then it's like, oh my God, like, yes, this is what I've been looking for. Like, this is the missing puzzle piece of my personal development. Like,
yeah.
And what was kind of one of the points that you thought, oh, I want to teach this. I want to facilitate these types of growth opportunities for others.
I don't know that there was one point. You know, I think what I really recall is just that I couldn't stop talking about it to people. Like, when I was learning it, it was like everyone in my life knew that I was learning this, you know, like everyone close to me was like, yes, Erin is learning this thing. It's called NVC. And you know, they really put up with a lot of my own kind of just journey of figuring out what it was about and sharing it. And so I think what sticks out to me is just phone conversations, like talking to friends about situations they were going through and just practicing empathy. Like, that's a big tool in nonviolent communication. We practice empathic listening, and how do you hold space for another person's experience in a non-judgmental way that allows them to find their way back to compassion? And doing that for people, and just, it just felt like magic, you know, like it was like, this is amazing. I can just sit here. I don't have to like fix anything for them. And then somehow through loving presence, they feel restored, you know? And so I was experiencing that with friends. And I was also firsthand experiencing that when I would receive empathy from people. And then I think it was really the encouragement of my teacher. You know, Carl Stayert was my original NVC teacher. And he was and still is so committed to supporting people to develop their leadership around work that matters to them. And I just got really lucky that it was a chapter when he was in Seattle for a period of, I think, 4 years or something, and just kind of invited me into his community and into his circle of practitioners that were endeavoring to do work in this realm, and mentored us and kind of modeled what it could look like. And so a lot of my confidence to teach came from co-facilitating with him, which when I look back, I was shaking in my boots. I mean, I was so nervous. It was such a big deal for me at the time. And even when I look back at like the first few months when I launched my practice without him, you know, it was like, whew, those were really intensely vulnerable times for me. It's amazing to look back and just see that, you know, I've always cared a lot about this work ever since I found it. But in terms of seeing myself as a teacher, it took a couple years of having people reflect that to me. But I always knew that I wanted to share it. I just had no idea that I'd be sharing it so formally and so widely.
Right. I think that's the beauty of it, just kind of naturally falling into place like that. Or of course, not saying that there was like naturally, like it's easy. It's just like, This is the natural evolution of your journey with this.
Yes.
Incredible. And in terms of like quickly speaking on mentorship, like the importance of having a mentor, mm-hmm. what would you say to that? To maybe those that don't feel that they have a mentor in their life?
I think it is such a beautiful gift to give oneself, to seek out a mentor. And I know for myself, the people who've been mentors in my life have reflected the possibilities that I could reach for or create for myself. They have reflected the gifts that I have. I think it's really normal whenever we start out in something that we can doubt ourselves a lot and compare ourselves a lot. And for me, that mentorship was really a place to validate the steps I was taking, to get feedback, and just to kind of have this tether to something beyond what I could see, you know, something beyond what I could imagine for myself. And it was just so important in building what I've built now and continues to be. And I would say, you know, you don't have to be in direct relationship with somebody to consider them a mentor. Like I have, mm-hmm. there are spiritual teachers that I consider mentors who've never met me, you know? So if you don't have a person in your life that you can have a one-on-one mentorship relationship with, I don't think that has to limit you. And the mentorship that I have had that has been in person with another human has been really amazing. And that goes for my nonviolent communication assessor too, Penny Wassman, who was one of sort of the original practitioners of MVC back in the day with Marshall, and just feel so fortunate to have had her guidance as well. So yeah, these are precious relationships.
Wow, beautiful, beautiful. I just know, I think back to myself and how I used to think that mentors meant in college, it's just someone that has like a job that's similar to what I want. And then it's just like about the job and that's it. And like, how do you like navigate through this career space instead of like a mentor, someone that kind of can, of course, has these maybe specific skills that I'm trying to develop as well. But also just how are they living their life? Like, how can I incorporate that type of life into mine? And so that was a big moment to me when I started finding people like that. Now, in nonviolent communication, when did kind of boundaries start to come into play?
Yeah, I do remember. So I was a student in a leadership program, an NBC-based leadership program, and one of the invitations there, it was a very experiential. There were 3 in-person retreats per year. Each of them were a week long. And one of the invitations was to give like a sample offering that people would give feedback to you. Mm-hmm. And I developed my boundary setting workshop because of that. I thought of, you know, just a topic that would be universal, that was also maybe not necessarily common in the NBC community. I had never attended a session on boundaries, so I saw that it was kind of a unique thing. And it's just a topic that has been interesting to me personally for a long time because of my history with growing up with a lot of people-pleasing tendencies and growing up socialized as a girl and a woman to be accommodating and easygoing and attentive to other people's needs. And so for those personal reasons, I just been interested in it. And then I started to see incredible levels of interest from people. Mm-hmm. And it's taken a while to refine the work so that it actually has my fingerprint on it. And that's something I'm really proud of with this particular work. It's the first body of work that feels like it's not all NBC. And that was an important juncture for me because in the first few years of my business, I was still such an active student of nonviolent communication that I was really obsessed with teaching it because I wanted to learn it, you know, and we teach what we need to learn so often. Mm-hmm. And I was also just really reliant on that particular modality. And what I've seen in the last few years here is just a real desire in myself to broaden my scope in terms of NVC as a beautiful, beautiful tool and one of many, and, you know, mastering other tools. And so what's exciting for me about the boundary work is that it grew from NVC, but then it has just evolved to include all these different healing modalities that I've found useful for myself, mm-hmm. my own voice coming through in a lot of the lectures and the tools, and also standing apart from a lot of the tools that I was seeing out there. That was another big inspiration behind creating that work, is that I would Google boundary setting and I would find all kinds of articles on how important boundaries were and how you needed to set them and, you know, how to learn how to say no. And I was like, great, but that's the beginning. Yeah. Give me the next step, because I know that I need to say no. I know that I need boundaries, like, obviously, but like, how do I do that in a way that's not dominating or manipulative, but it's also not self-sacrificing? How do I do that? How do I actually genuinely dismantle the conditioning of the people-pleasing behaviors so that I'm not up against that inner turmoil every single time that I have to set a boundary? So that was really the inspiration, was just like the how of boundary setting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For those that are maybe in the similar boat of like, they know that I need to set boundaries, but like, they don't even know what that means. Like, how would you even define a boundary?
Yeah. So simplest definition is actually borrowed from Brené Brown, and she just says, what's okay and what's not okay. That's, for me, that's just the most bare bones way of thinking about a boundary. What's okay and what's not okay, according to me. Not according to anybody else, but for me and my personal sense of what's okay and not okay. I expand a little bit on that definition. And for me, the definition is the line between my true yes and my no in relation to my needs. So it's a little bit more technical, but it's capturing, you know, our true yes without getting too sort of didactic on you here. Our true yes is what we say yes to consciously from a place of choice with no resentment and no blame. And our false yes is more of our conditioning, like what we say yes to out of obligation, what we say yes to because we believe we have to, what we say yes to out of fear. And so that's kind of a really important piece of understanding our boundaries, is delineating between the false yes and the true yes. Mm-hmm. And we're always looking for the true yes. We're peeling back the layers to find it. So the boundary is the line between my true yes and no, and then in relation to my needs, because as you mentioned too, you know, it's really life-changing to wake up and realize, wow, I have needs and they matter. And I think that's such an essential part of understanding our boundaries, is that we're always rooting our boundaries into the things that matter deeply to us. And no boundary is superficial. Every boundary touches something much deeper that comes to be the makeup of our sense of overall well-being, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's kind of a starting point for defining a boundary.
Love that. And I, even though, like, going through, you know, so many of your classes, it wasn't until our one-on-one session that I made that full connection that the boundaries, are like some of my boundary setting is connected to, like, that, how did you just say it? Like, it's connected to, like, deeper, like, feelings and needs.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like how you said, it's map. It creates like this map, like, mm-hmm. in itself. And this is getting like kind of more abstract for those that are like just diving into this, but it's like, here's the boundary. Here's the line. And it's like connected to,
yes,
these feelings and needs behind it.
Absolutely. I mean, what you're describing, Seth, I think it's like boundaries work. What I love about it, why I'm just like on fire about it, is that it's both extremely practical, but also the deepest spiritual work we can possibly do, because in order to look at our boundaries honestly and to bring them in a clean way, we have to peel back the layers of our conditioned self, and we have to stand in the truth of who we are. And that is quite a journey. Every time we look at a boundary, there's some piece of a previous identity lingering in that lack of clarity around a boundary, right? And we have to figure out what needs healing, what needs releasing, what needs grieving. And that's the work that I endeavor to do with people. And I try to make it, you know, really simple, straightforward processes that will take you to the core of what's important in that work.
Wow. Love that. When people pleasing, What were some of your people-pleasing tendencies?
I'm like, I don't know where to begin. I'm pausing because I could go on forever about this. I would say a big people-pleasing behavior was saying yes to anything another person expressed needing from me.
Mm-hmm.
Like feeling a strong pressure every time that someone that I felt needed by somebody, right? That I perceived I was needed. I gave a workshop a couple weeks ago, and I shared this story, but it really does kind of sum up, you ask what people pleasing looked like for me. When I was living in Germany, I worked two jobs. And so I was working as a waitress at an Irish pub and then a preschool teacher at an English language preschool. And I really loved both of those jobs. And my foot developed a condition that I now know is something called cuboid syndrome, and the bone can spontaneously dislocate with almost no impact or stimulus for that to happen. And so it's a very, very painful experience because you're essentially walking around with like a kind of a broken bone in your foot, and it can take weeks or months to get back in place. So it's kind of a, just like a really challenging injury. And it's very difficult to walk when that's happening because the cuboid is at the bottom of the foot. It really supports most of your weight. It's kind of right by your heel. So this happened for the first time when I was working both of those jobs, which both involved a lot of walking and lifting and moving. I kept going to work for a week, limping around, trying to carry these 2.5-year-olds, trying to hold the tray of beers. Like, I kept going to work because I had such a strong belief that I had to. And for me, that's what people pleasing is, right? It's unconscious sacrifices we're making to our health or well-being or sanity or stability in order to fulfill what we think other people want. And the big underline there is think, what we think other people want. Mm-hmm. And the story goes that, you know, eventually both of my bosses were like, you can't come to work, Erin. Like, go take care of yourself, get some medical attention. And that's also such an inherent part of people pleasing, is that often the things we're doing that we think are helping others aren't actually serving the way we think they are. So no one's really winning in this people pleasing equation. And if they are, it's probably a symptom of an unhealthy relationship dynamic that's ready to transform anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of what people pleasing look like. I had a lot of trouble telling people when something would happen that I didn't like, or when something would hurt my feelings or something would make me angry. I remember my roommate in Germany, it was near the holidays. I had baked some cookies, and she and her sister came home, and I had left them on the kitchen counter, which was just sort of a mutually acknowledged signal, like, you can eat whatever's left out on the counter. But I didn't think they would actually eat all the cookies, but they did. They almost ate almost all of the cookies, she and her sister. And I watched it happen. I remember walking by and seeing it, and they were like, they even asked me, like, is it okay that we're eating this? And I was like, yeah, even though everything in me was just furious and like, I can't believe they're doing this. I had such a strong programming that I could not say, yeah, Seth is like giving me this look of like disbelief because he knows me now. And like, the Erin of today would never let this happen. So I ended up baking a second batch of cookies that same night, staying up late, baking a second batch of cookies because they were for my ex's family. So that's just to give you like some of the flavor of what people pleasing, kind of the stronghold that that had on my psyche and my behavior. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, let me know if this, if you relate to this, of getting to the point where you're communicating your needs and your boundaries, and maybe like this attaching to people pleasing, your whole body in that story was like lighting up, and like you felt the anger and you felt the like that was not being expressed or released or communicated, all that. Mm-hmm. Was there a part in your journey where you would begin to just have like be able to notice that something's happening where it's not an intense response in your body, though you know something's up?
Yeah. I mean, so a number of things came up when you asked this. One was, you know, when I used to have this information from my body, like anger, frustration, rage, confusion, worry, like any of these signals, when I used to feel that in my body, in my physical self, I would look outside for the source of that. So I would go, what's happening out there that's making this happen in me? Which is a valid place to look. But more useful is, where is this coming from inside of me, from my perception of what's happening, right? So it's this kind of critical shift from what are other people doing to me to what am I perceiving and how can I advocate for myself around that? Where do I need to see reality more clearly? Where have I maybe created an interpretation that is taking me down a painful track inside myself that I have choice to step out of? And where is there something legitimate happening? So that was one thing that came up when you asked that. And I want to make sure I understand your question. Are you saying, like, are there times when maybe the body cue isn't super strong, but I can sense that something is a little bit off?
Yeah.
So not all triggers are screaming through body sensation. Some of them are, but a lot of them are just a really subtle. I mean, I do think a lot of them show up in the body, just maybe not as loud as others. So a subtle feeling in my gut that something's off. Hearing myself say something that just doesn't quite resonate with the truth that I know is deep inside. I guess as I'm thinking of this out loud, I really do think so much of it is tied into my body, but it is, there's a spectrum of how loud those signals are.
Mm-hmm. And how about something that happens for me is I begin to get quiet, or I do like self-silencing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that show up for you in these moments?
Yeah. Yes. So it shows up in, let me think of an example. This is a good one. So often what will happen for me when I'm experiencing what you're describing and that self-silencing is actually what I notice first is the belief system that I don't belong.
Okay.
So any version of a thought like, I don't belong here, my voice doesn't matter, these people don't care what I have to say. And I'm familiar enough with that kind of that wounding in myself that when that comes up, I can pretty quickly notice, wow, something's going on for you, Erin, you know, and I can start to investigate what's going on. And in my most courageous, resourced moments, I can name it out loud, vulnerably, with the group that I'm with. But at a minimum, I'm able to just kind of offer myself some compassion and some love in that moment to the part of me that you know, got scared and went quiet as a result of that fear.
I see. And when you think to yourself about the moments that you've like kind of broken through and been empowered to speak your truth, and maybe relationships where you haven't for so long, and there's kind of like, I remember in one of the classes saying that it's almost like both parties have to go through a grieving experience once your like true yes, so your needs are finally spoken when they haven't been for so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What would you say to that those types of experiences and how it's still important to get to that point? Like in those relationships to bring that up.
Yeah. There's so much to say about this. So I can just feel the tenderness of this question because it takes a lot to bring our truth to relationships that matter to us. And especially to bring the truth when we realize that we have been unconsciously or consciously pretending or hiding in a relationship. And so I have a lot of empathy for this topic and a lot of firsthand experience of both being the person who brings a truth that's hard to bring and the person who receives a truth that's hard to receive. And in both cases, there is such an incredible gift in leaning into the discomfort of accepting the truth of what is real in a relationship. Accepting somebody's experience of me that I wouldn't desire or I wouldn't want. Accepting the ways that I have been out of alignment with my truth and I have enabled an unhealthy dynamic to persist. And so there's a beautiful gift if we can hang in there, if we can really lean in. And not every relationship has the conditions that are appropriate for us to do that. And I think that's another really important choice point whenever we start looking at our relationships and taking stock of our patterns and where we want to bring more authenticity. Not every relationship is meant to be a vehicle for authenticity for us. Some relationships, I believe, come into our life to show us where our boundaries are, or to teach us a core lesson, or to give us a meaningful experience, and then for us to move on. And other relationships really are here to be crucibles for us. And so when I have leaned into that crucible in relationships, there has been a grieving process that has to take place on both sides. And in some ways, the relationship that was previously there has to die. And that is a tragic experience every single time, because our relationships are precious to us. But what I have seen happen over and over again is that the reinvented relationship is so much more deeply satisfying. And I've had this in several core relationships in my life. And it's so worth it when the conditions are in place for this to be a mutually growthful, healing experience. The possibility for evolution and transformation and love and intimacy, even in our friendships. I'm not just talking romantic relationships, in our parental relationships and our sibling relationships, any relationship is just so amazing.
Oh my gosh. It's so good. It's the idea of transforming a relationship. Do you know of any resources out there, any books that talk about this? Because I still have yet to hear about one. And it's almost like this research that I'm doing, that there aren't that many points of data besides being a great communicator, being great at setting boundaries. Because that's the only ways that I know of creating the healthiest relationship that has the possibility to be whatever it needs to be, whatever it's both desired from. Yeah. Even if that changes.
Wow. I, you know, you bring up such a good point, because I can't think off the top of my head of a book that really articulates that journey and kind of walks us through that. I can think of stories that have helped me and inspired me. So one is, I love the work of Esther Perel. She works with couples. I think majority of the couples she works with have experienced infidelity, mm-hmm. or experienced some long-standing issue and are on the brink of separating, or they have already separated and they're exploring getting back together. And she has a podcast called something like Where Should We Begin, or Where Do We Begin? That was like a really blew my mind in terms of the level of rawness and realness that those conversations bring. Basically, the podcast is just a bunch of sessions that she facilitates for couples. And she's kind of this, she reveals all of the patterns that are underneath the conflicts you're hearing and the stories you're hearing. And so you both hear her facilitating the sessions, but she also pauses and speaks just to the audience, where she says, in this moment, you know, such and such a person is resisting the grief of blah, blah, blah. You know, she sort of narrates what's going on. And that was just totally fascinating to me.
Wow. So
that's something I recommend. And then the other that I think gets at this a little bit is anything by Glennon Doyle. She's an author that I
read. Oh, nice. Mm-hmm.
And I just totally devoured her book, Untamed. I think she does such a beautiful job of articulating becoming ourselves, and doing that in relationship, doing that in the midst of life, not in the privacy of a spiritual retreat or, you know, in these, you know, like hidden moments, but really doing that out loud in front of others. And her memoirs are just a really beautiful expression of that.
Wow. Was there some moments in the book that really spoke to you?
Oh yeah. I have said this is one of my favorite books I've ever read. I think I cry in just about every chapter, whether it's sad or not. I cry because it resonates. So there are so many chapters that resonate, but the kind of the core metaphor in the book at the very beginning is she's at the zoo with her family and they go to see this cheetah run, which is the, you know, the big event. And they watch as this cheetah does this run that they have crafted for it. And it's like this caged experience where they attach a dirty pink bunny to the back of a vehicle and the vehicle speeds off and the cheetah is meant to chase down this dirty pink bunny. And then it gets a stake at the end. And she uses this as a metaphor of how society cages us and gives us these dirty pink bunnies that we'll never be able to catch, and rewards us with a stake and tells us your life is good enough like this. And what she observes when she's at the zoo is that at the end of this experience, she's watching the cheetah and it starts to like sniff the wind and look and, you know, look around and shows these signs of wildness again. And she uses that as a metaphor for the wild that exists in all of us, that part of us that is untamed, that existed, that pre-existed all of our conditioning. And that's that part of us that says, I know that there is something more beautiful than this. And then we talk ourselves out of it. I should be grateful that I have this beautiful place to live, that I have this comfortable life where they feed me steak when I chase the dirty pink bunny. So, that's kind of the premise of the whole book. And it's really just an exquisite exploration of untaming ourselves and coming into the truth of who we are and, you know, everything to do with self-love.
Wow. What was the dirty pink bunny and steak for you?
Probably different in each chapter in my life.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. I think the dirty pink bunny is any form of approval, external approval. And the steak is, it's almost like they're the same thing. Like the approval is what I'm seeking and it's the reward. It's like this false reward, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
So
it's like approval from others.
Yeah.
Yourself. I got lost.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't approve of this. Like, this is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that for me, I think all of us seek approval in different ways. For me, what I've really worked with that's brought up a lot of shadow stuff for me is like being good.
Mm-hmm.
Any form of being good was like the thing that I wanted in my life. So to be successful, to be loving, to be conscious, these ideals that are beautiful, but that don't capture the complexity of our humanity and that lend themselves to conditional self-love.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the realm of self-love, do you feel like there, or think that there are areas in which you would love to see more research on?
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, first, I guess I would just love for self-love to not carry any stigma. I think that a lot of us are like really supportive of this framework of self-love, and you know, I benefited so much from it, but I think that it can also be seen as so many sort of feminized areas of personal development are seen as just kind of this woo-woo thing, or this soft, weak practice. So I would love anything that could normalize and kind of just shift any negative cultural narratives around that. So that's my first response. What area of research would I love to see around self-love? I'm really fascinated by addiction. I'm kind of surprised I'm even saying this. Like, I wouldn't have thought of this, but I just heard of so many people struggling with addiction for whom the 12-step approach doesn't resonate. Mm-hmm. And I would be really curious, and I'm sure it's already happening, but just so curious, like, how could we apply principles of self-love to any form of addiction? Mm-hmm. And also broadening our definitions around addiction. And I just think, yeah, there's so much to be gained in that field. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like, I certainly understand that a lot of the resources available do really support a lot of people, and I'd love to see even more.
Cool. That's awesome. I know from my view of addiction has changed a lot. And I think if I look at my kind of like past addiction to video games, used to, you know, be a lot of like detached of like who I am, kind of. There's so much behind it. And at least I'm currently working off the belief that if I am fully loving myself, if I'm like fully connected to who I am, I won't be seeking like behaviors or habits that have negative impacts on my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I love that's kind of in the realm of interest that or at least that sparks that idea in your mind, and would love to see more into that. So that's really cool.
Yeah, I like that principle. And I'm always, just because I have such a strong history of perfectionism, I'm always wary of like absolutes that I set for myself. I'm not saying you were, I'm just, mm-hmm. when I hear your principle, I can go, oh, that's a slippery slope for me. When I think of it as, when I'm no longer seeking those habits that have a negative impact on my life, then I'll finally be worthy. Then I'll finally be good. Right. And mm-hmm. so I think such a, just like another layer of the whole self-love journey is like, and when I do seek the behavior that negatively impacts my life, can I forgive myself for that? Can I be unconditionally loving with myself in the face of the behaviors I see myself do that I know are not good for me? And that's really what I'm getting at with like, how could we apply this to addiction? How can we apply this to trauma, for example? It would be so cool to see trauma education become mainstream. Mm-hmm. So that anytime we see someone get into a dysregulated state, we go, oh, they're in a dysregulated state. Okay, here's our de-escalation method that we know of. Here's something that can help in this situation. You know, if we just had some basic education about that, it could be such a huge revelation for our society.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, that would be, because I know in our circles, it's talked about quite a bit, which is great. And it's time to bring it out there. It's time to just get it all, just get it out. Because there's just so much good knowledge. I mean, I just finally learned, I thought I knew what the term trauma bonding meant. And then I finally like looked it up And I was like completely wrong. It's like,
wow, will you share it? I don't even know.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's like there's, oh my gosh. Okay, let's get it out. This was from the holistic psychologist. Let's see if we can get this.
I love the work of the holistic psychologist. I think I just discovered her. Isn't it what's her name?
God.
Nicole or something?
This sounds, yeah, what is her name?
Nicole Pereira, I think, or something.
Nicole LaPera.
LaPera, I was close.
Yeah, there we go. Okay, where can we find, okay, she has just so many great posts. Oh man, there's so many posts here. Self-healers, codependency. There's so much codependency. It's great. Trauma bonds explained. Here we go. The attachments / relationships we have with parents or caregivers before age 5 set the foundation for our adult relationships. This is because we are born completely dependent on adults who, ideally, will meet our physical plus emotional needs. If our needs are met, we have secure / safe attachments. If our needs are not met, we have insecure, unpredictable attachments. Our brains are still developing during this time, plus we can become addicted to the same biological responses in the brain and nervous system when we enter adult relationships. There becomes an unconscious drive to repeat the same dynamics we learned as infants plus children. Trauma bonds are relationships where we repeat the same dynamics we experienced in childhood with a parent through a romantic partner or close friend. Mm. And so there's the consistent theme in trauma bonds is the betrayal of oneself in order to receive love. Ooh.
Wow.
Damn. It's like the same betrayal pattern we unconsciously began as children in order to receive love plus validation from a parent we had a conflicted relationship with. And then there are 4 more slides of this. You know, it's like, oh, so.
That's amazing. I love her work. I just want to shout it out again because I think everyone can benefit. Yeah. The holistic psychologist, Nicole LaPera. My goodness. I just discovered her and I'm like all about it.
It's just so great. It's so good. And she has the best hashtag self-healers. Come on. She's doing great. She's killing on that marketing game.
Totally.
Is there anything else in the realm of self-love that you want others to know about?
You know, one of the things I discovered in the last few years here that I thought was just kind of like not a valid tool, but is now one of my go-to practices is EFT, tapping.
Oh, yeah.
And specifically Brad Yates is just an awesome teacher. He's all over YouTube. He has over 900 videos. I really dig it. And I think that people don't know about it, or when they do, like sort of my experience that happened for me, I think is very common, where it's sort of like, how could this work? It's so simple. And it doesn't really connect if we don't have an understanding of the energy meridians in our body, or, you know, where to tap on your body. But I would say that that's been one of these kind of like secret weapons of self-love. Uh-huh. We need a better metaphor there, but one of my go-to practices. Yeah. One of my go-to practices that, like, okay, if I'm in a dysregulated state, if I'm in a shame spiral, this will always help. It may not always completely pull me out of what I'm experiencing, but it will get me back into enough balance to use my other tools. Mm-hmm. So I would say looking up Brad Yates on tapping. You know, I think such a huge part of my self-love, and I'm not assuming this is true for everyone, but such a huge part of it has been finding a spiritual practice or a spiritual teacher that really resonates, because for me, it's just helped to have a deeper understanding of what these tools are serving for me. And that it's not just about making myself better. Like, I think it's easy to kind of fall into that sort of societal brainwashing of like just making ourselves these optimal, perfect humans. And my spiritual practice really roots me in like kind of taking me back out of that conditioned goal and into wanting to be at peace, wanting to be the clearest expression of my soul that I can be. So I guess I would just offer that for people who are exploring self-love. You know, it's just really helped to ground it for me in something deeper than just growing and optimizing how I am and really coming into the truth of who I am.
Love it. Because who doesn't love living in their truth, huh?
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't? Come on. Who doesn't? I don't know. I'm living as truthfully as I can. It's really every time I do that, every step of the way, just seems to get better. And Erin, I know, and I want to tell the world that you have incredible nonviolent communication classes that are happening. There's like the cycle. I mean, of course, they're all online right now.
Yeah.
Same with your boundary setting classes. You're also doing a workshop in expansion. When is that?
June 3rd, I'm doing a workshop on compassionate communication. That would be a great intro for people who are kind of new to NVC or who want to just kind of feel it out. Also a great refresher for people who are already familiar. I also, you know, Seth, this whole pandemic experience, I feel very fortunate that I've been able to leverage this time as my own kind of spiritual retreat, creative retreat. Mm-hmm. Obviously my work has continued, but I'm also behind the scenes creating a lot of new stuff. And I want to just give you some hints about those things so that you and others can look out for them. I'm actually developing a whole series on shame and working with shame, because similar to boundaries, we all know that shame is really devastating, both from just the mental health perspective and from a relational perspective. But I personally don't know of like one place to go where I know that I'm going to get the tools to work with shame. And it's a really, really complex and messy area of work. And so I'm really excited to be developing that. So look out for that coming up. I think it's probably going to be called Shame Liberation, the Shame Liberation series. So that's one exciting offering. I always have my Boundaries Without Backlash work happening. That's a 3-month program, so kind of happens seasonally. I am trying to offer compassionate communication intro series and advanced series as often as I can. And then the other thing I'm really excited about that also grew out of this quarantine time is my HeartSpark monthly membership. So I realized that a lot of people who've connected with my work, you know, they've taken sort of like you, like they've taken all my courses, they've done all the Erin Merrihew things they can do. And then it's like, how can I stay connected with the work until you develop your next series or whatever it is? And so the HeartSpark membership is kind of this spiritual home base for people. And you get an email in your inbox the first of every month that gives you a video that I create with a special topic and some invitations for the month ahead, gives you a digital handout with some writings from me, some journal prompts. This month had some song recommendations to help you integrate the topic. Wow. And then you get an audio track that is a guided meditation. And if you've ever taken a class with me, you know that I love to leave guided meditations at the beginning of my classes.
So
they're
good.
Totally intuitive. And so people have been just begging me for those. So that's all included in the monthly membership. And that would also be a fun way for people to connect with my work. It's like a, you know, kind of a low stakes entry point to just kind of see what I'm about and experience something with me.
Wow. That is so, I mean, I didn't know we were about to get a little sneak preview just of this shame liberation course. Oh my gosh, this is like, guys, this is a big deal. This is a big deal. Oh my gosh, that is so exciting. I can't wait to like see what that comes out. That's so cool. And you're teaching 3 days before mine? That's so awesome. I'm like, it's like such an honor to be on the same lineup as you, like seeing.
Oh, I love that.
Headlining.
I love that. I'm so excited. And what a cool, I mean, we are among just so many incredible humans offering incredible things for that. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. And doing the monthly membership. HeartSpark, awesome. I'll make sure to post all the links, all these in the podcast description, all that good stuff. Yeah. Aaron, this has been incredible. This is like, yeah, this just every day, anything's possible. Dreams come true. You know the deal. Like, you know how it is. It's only getting better. Like, yeah.
Well, thank you, Seth. It's really an honor and a pleasure and just so fun to be sitting here talking with you and just knowing our history and you come into my class for the first time. Flash forward to this day. It's just really sweet. So thank you for having me.
Amazing. Yeah. Any freaking time.
Love and. Well, we really did it this time, friends. Follow at Aaron Merrihue on Instagram. Check out her Expansion Festival workshop on June 3rd at 11 a.m. I put all these links in the description. I've taken both of her Compassionate Communication, Advanced NVC, and Boundaries Without Backlash workshops. Those two categories of boundaries and nonviolent communication. Took them both. I can't wait for her shame liberation workshops and classes. I just know that they're going to be incredible. I believe it's just so deeply in her work and what she's doing. And I want to thank you, Aaron, once again for being on the show. It's unbelievable. So with that, my friends, we got my expansion workshop on June 6th at 11 a.m. Check out the ticket link that I put at the bottom. That way the funds go towards me. Yeah, stay tuned for Blast Into Self-Love, the freaking course. It's happening. It's on its way. You might have seen on Instagram some of the behind the scenes with that. It's just getting really exciting. Like, I cannot believe how fast all of this is unfolding. Thank you for being with me on the journey. I know it just seems like every milestone moment for myself is just so exciting, and I'm just full of life. I'm just living it. I'm freaking in Gasworks Park right now where there's a jazz band playing at the top of the mountain. You know, like, life's good. Everything is great. It's beautiful, sunny day. Ah, love yourselves out there. Damn.
This was Love Amped, a podcast by Seth Pearson. Check out loveamped.com for more info on today's topic.